Thank you for listening to Overleveraged, where we explore the big macro themes affecting investors, economic imbalances, giant geopolitical trends, tail risks and tremors, and everywhere risks are not being fully priced into markets. Remember, trading carries risk, and all opinions are provided as general market commentary only. Please do your own research. Our risk warning will follow at the end. Hello and welcome to Overleveraged. And this week's special guest is Andy Sylvester from CityM, the editor at CityM. So well versed in all things financial news media. Thanks for joining us.
Hopefully, if I'm doing my job right. No, it's lovely to be here. Thanks, Neil.
No, thank you for coming in. It's much appreciated. I think it's going to be interesting to look at newspapers because things have changed quite a lot. And even in quite a short space of time, we've seen things change. I'm just going to play a little clip, which hopefully you'll enjoy.
As political editor of The Spectator, I have reported on numerous controversies at Westminster, but never one quite as divisive as the Chancellor's decision to announce the budget during Cheltenham Week. The move has been greeted with horror by MPs in the House.
It's an absolute national disgrace. And there was a Chancellor of the Exchequer after the war, Stafford Cripps, who had to resign because he gave away some budgetary secrets. This goes far beyond that. This is such an insult to all the thousands of people who will be at Cheltenham, all the devotees of racing, and our four-legged friends. This is a resignation matter, in my view.
But seriously, scandalous.
So that was the slightly hilarious stramash about Gordon Brown shifting the budget to the week of Cheltenham, the racing week. And that caused a lot of concern among financial news journalists at the time.
Cheltenham was the week off. Everybody shut down for 3 to 4 days. And I mean, it's not too long ago in the rearview mirror this year, and our office was quieter maybe than it usually is, but alas, such days of debauchery I think are in the past. I think digital media put paid to that, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think that's from 2004.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes to the point really of the fact that things have changed a considerable amount, even in the last 20 odd years. This episode, we want to look at the role of news media, and particularly newspapers, I think, in financial markets, because the history goes quite a long way back, and it's quite and the reason it's interesting, I think the reason we want to talk about it is because of the interplay and the sort of almost symbiotic relationship that we've had in the world of finance and the world of newspapers. And it goes all the way back to
the start of finance in London, really, to the old coffee houses of the City of London, which were, of course, you know, famously hotbeds of gossip as traders met to chat to each other. But right from the start, you know, you paid your penny to get into the coffee house. The newspapers were dotted around the place, pamphlets, leaflets.
Yeah.
Lloyd's was, you know, Mr. Lloyd's was among the first to do so.
Yeah.
He had a thing called Lloyd's News. That went... it stopped printing actually after they printed something about the House of Lords, which at the time came with £1,000 penalty. So he decided to shut the thing rather than pay the bill.
Yeah.
And of course, that later, having clocked, hang on, people are interested in this business news stuff.
Yeah.
This idea of people printing out on a piece of paper the news. That, of course, became Lloyd's List. And, you know, from there spawned business journalism, really.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's actually, it even maybe goes further back than that, because it was Robert Shiller, who we'll come to a bit later, because he's written quite a lot about the role of the media in terms of speculative bubbles, and that's quite an interesting topic that we'll come to. You know, he notes that, this was a few years ago, he was talking about the first real newspapers appeared around the 1600s in Holland, and that was also around the time of the Dutch tulip bubble. And his quote is, "I can't find much evidence of financial bubbles before then." And he's saying that, you know, newspapers and bubbles aren't coincidental. The big fluctuations of bubbles are primarily social, psychological changes, and you need media to do that. So the relationship between media and, well, newspapers are obviously originally and the financial markets is very deep and very instantly connected.
Yeah, no, absolutely. from the off, I mean, why do people want to spend time with the media? They want to feel informed. They want to feel one step ahead of the competition. They want to be part of this wider conversation. And of course, it doesn't take much to extrapolate that to what a newspaper would mean then in business and finance. You want to be one step ahead of the competition. You want to be part of that wider conversation. You want to know what other people are talking about, because there's always that, you know, in finance, you never want to be, well, this is a bigger question, but do you always want to be, you don't want to stray too far from what everybody else is thinking. You might want your,
you want the outliers,
but you don't want to be too far off the herd. And newspapers, I think more broadly, but in finance as well, from our side, from the media side, it's always that you don't want to stray too far from what your readers think. You know, you don't want to take them off in very huge different directions, because it won't scan for them. But it becomes a feedback loop. You know, if your readers start to get excited by Dutch tulips, and you get excited by Dutch tulips, and then more people get excited by Dutch tulips, and then suddenly there's tulips everywhere.
You know, that's the sort of, or the kind of argument that is, does the media reflect what people are, or does it drive it? Is it a driving force behind bubbles, or not in a bubble, but just the narrative, and creating a narrative is a major part of what the news media has been able to do. And you know, even if we look at, say, indices, so the stock market, the index, the FTSE 100, which you know, everyone will have heard about and will know about, and that's the result of, well, it's the Financial Times. I mean, originally Financial News.
Yeah, originally Financial News. There were two papers originally. There was Financial News, which was first 1870. I'm going to pluck from the air, but somewhere in that region, which was closely followed by the FT. Students of irony will enjoy the fact the FT was the anti-elitist paper at the time.
So it was not the deep state. As Liz Truss said.
It was the pamphlet for, you know, the honest stockbroker. Financial News was felt to be a bit establishment. It was felt to be a little bit, as I say, elitist, maybe for people that have made it rather than people that are making it.
Right.
And the FT, which started out as four pages, became a little bit of an upstart. Its real moment, when it became a real big deal in the city, there were two things. One, it went pink, salmon pink, 1893. And then the second thing was the First World War, when the Financial News went off in a very strange direction, where it was sort of trying to root out fifth columnists in the city, and the FT just kept on. Well, indeed. And then they eventually came together in 1945. But yeah, you're right. Financial News came up with the index, not of 100, of course, at the time.
It was the 30, I think. Yeah, so the FTSE 30 in 1935.
Yeah.
I've got reliably on my notes in front
of me.
Yeah,
that sounds about right. And then, of course, the FT owner at the time in 1945, also in the Telegraph, offered the papers the Financial News, all sorts of theories as to why, but an incoming Labour government, ironically, seems to be one of the main reasons, offered it to Financial News. Financial News realised the way the wind was blowing, took the FT name, and never looked back.
Yeah, and so, you know, it goes to the point of, you know, I guess going back to the Lloyds and all that, you know, how do you get your information out there as a company? And the news media is obviously key. But there's this sort of driving force that the media, the papers, become an accelerant or a driver in their own right. So there's the FTSE 100, there's the Dow, which is the first index. Again, Charles Dow, his customer's afternoon letter, which was a two-page financial news bulletin. I mean, it must have been great back then, 1884, and that was the precursor to the Wall Street Journal. So the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which we know and is part of our, you know...
It's how we measured the health of things, right?
Yeah, what's the Dow doing? What's the FTSE doing?
Yeah.
Those were inventions of newspapers. And I think, you know, that is about creating that narrative. And that's what the papers are very good at doing.
Yeah.
And maybe too good at doing sometimes.
Yeah, arguably sometimes. You know, the first thing any journalist is taught as a 21-year-old is you need to tell stories. You know, that means context, but it also means something looking forward. What does it mean? What's it going to build? How does this grow? And indices are a wonderful way of telling those stories, and it allows you you know, every 3 months when the FTSE does its reshuffle, yeah. It allows us to do story. EasyJet, obviously, on the way, I think EasyJet, I'm not sure when this is coming out, but EasyJet, when they get back in the FTSE 100, there's stories all weekend about, you know, EasyJet has taken off, you know, they've come out the back end of the pandemic.
Never miss a good pun.
Because they're back in the FTSE 100. Now, is the business fundamentally different this week than it was last week? Of course not. But
so that, yeah, that's key.
It creates this sort of the warmth around the business that maybe wouldn't be there otherwise. And
yeah, so it's not the indexation is not an essential component of the functioning of the market. It just tells the story to the audience and to the people who are in part of the market.
Yeah, it tells a story to those people that are heavily invested in it. Financially as well as spiritually, for want of a better phrase. But, you know, it also provides the narrative, and this is where you get the crossover from business journalism to the wider journalism space. It tells a story about health of an economy. And the bulletins, the radio bulletins, the business news is very brief, but it usually involves the FTSE 100 was up today or the FTSE 100 was down today. Yeah. And politicians then, of course, latch onto that if it's good news or bad news. Donald Trump talks about the record health of the US stock market when he was there. Now, one can argue until the cows come home about how engaged or involved Trump policies were in that. But it does create a story. And without business journalists telling those stories, it's just money moving around. You know, you need the stories to tie everything together and give people something to talk about over lunch. You need something.
That's it. Yeah, and it's a human story. And, and the numbers on a screen or a ticker don't really convey it in the same. So you need that intermediary to tell the story for you.
And you need winners and losers as well, which is the other
thing. That's the other thing.
Because storytelling usually has somebody doing well, somebody not doing so well. And those are the stories that take off. We get live, real-time data on what stories people are reading. And it's very rarely the companies that produce updates, which, you know, they meet expectations and shares bubble along exactly as they are. You know, company does badly, company does well, beat expectations, misses. Those are the ones that people want to read.
Yeah, and everyone likes a drama as well.
Everyone loves a drama.
A crash is always a great... some good headlines. I mean, obviously you can't see these because we're doing a podcast, but there's some great headlines from the 1929 crash, from 1987. I've got a particularly good one from... So 1929 was obviously the big crash, and that sparked lots of soul-searching and a big economic recession, but Variety, which I think was the Broadway publication, so even Broadway, which is all about stage and screen, and their headline is "Wall Street Lays an Egg," which I don't quite understand, but
I'm not sure I'd put it on the front today, but yeah, when you talk about those moments in time when financial journalism does really reinforce a narrative, create a narrative, it is in those moments of drama. Which opens up a kind of philosophical question about how responsible a journalist, an editor must be in those moments where if you hype this up in a certain way, are you playing a part in something that is bad news? You know, that's going to have an impact on people. In 1929, you know, those stockbrokers throwing themselves out of windows that we hear about, perhaps apocryphally, you never know, but they'll have read the papers that morning and it'll have all looked very grim. And that does lead back to that question about when you have to be level-headed and when you have to be excited.
Well, I've got a good one, so I'm gonna jump in here because I've got a good one from City AM, which is your paper. So this is from 2011, Bloodbath.
It's not subtle, is it?
That's a good one, though. I mean, I'm not quite sure it's a G20 event in Cannes or something. I don't know how it caused so much concern, but you've got the FTSE down almost 5% on the day, so it's a big day.
Well, that's the other thing, of course, is that when things happen, you obviously have to put stuff on the front and you want to create drama every day.
Yeah.
You and I can't remember what that's about. No. We can remember, you know, clearly 2011, something happened and it was all bad for a week or so, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not going to be part of economic history. But on the front page that day, it looked like the most important thing that had ever happened. So. Yeah.
And then on that narrative idea, I've got another, the New York Times from 1987 when the market crashed, which was a massive crash. Mm. And there was an instant on the front page, is, does 1987 equal 1929? So instantly, the news media is instantly trying to draw that narrative,
yeah, absolutely.
To draw that connection, which, you know, to the traders and investors on the floor, it doesn't, it's irrelevant whether it was bigger or smaller than 1929. But we when we look at it from slightly on the outside, we need that narrative.
And the charitable way of looking at it is you're trying to explain to readers through their frame of reference what's going on. You're trying to inform. And everybody that worked in Wall Street in 87 will have been aware of 29, right? And and you are trying to say this is maybe not as bad, but we're in that territory.
Yeah.
And as I say, the charitable way is to call that informing. There is a less charitable explanation, which is hype sells papers.
Yeah.
And particularly in, even in the 80s, it what you put on the front page mattered to whether your paper got picked up, right? The world has changed now, which we'll come back to.
Yeah.
But even then, the job was to create something that people felt they had to grab. And of course, putting on the front page, bad crash, probably not as bad as 29.
Yeah,
doesn't encourage you to pick it up in the same way, but that question of, oh, does it?
Yeah.
You know, well, I must pick up this newspaper and pay my 5 cents in order to get it. It's sometimes, I think sometimes people overcomplicate the way they talk about the media. You want people to pick it up, and that's why stuff's on the front page. And the more exciting you can make it, of course, the more likely it is to be picked up.
Definitely. And you know, coming on to that idea of responsibility, and there's you know, does the media play a part in bad stuff? Because that's kind of, you know, it's easy to be playing a part in the good stuff. You report your RNS updates every morning and so on. And that, but, you know, I think I quoted Shiller, Robert J. Shiller already, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist, a big deal. His book, Irrational Exuberance, he writes that the news media are fundamental propagators of speculative price movements through their efforts to make news interesting to their audience. I mean, you know, that sort of makes me think of the Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca saying, you know, there's gambling going on here. And I'm shocked.
Yeah, no, I'll take the hit. I'll accept the charge.
And he goes on, they sometimes strive to enhance such interest by attaching news stories to price movements that the public has already observed, thereby enhancing the salience of these movements and focusing greater attention on them. Or they may remind the public of past market episodes of likely trading strategies of others. Thus, the media can sometimes foster stronger feedback from past price changes to further price changes. So in other words, sort of fueling the fire of whatever it is that's happening already.
Yeah, but rarely coming out of nowhere, which I think is the interesting point. You know, it's not... It's quite difficult. We do it occasionally. You have an exclusive story or whatever. It's actually quite difficult sometimes to create the narrative around something that's totally new that people weren't thinking about before they picked up the paper.
Yeah.
Because their brain isn't there. They have to be reminded of it. You have to spend quite a lot of time in the story explaining why this is important. Whereas if it's just, you know, Tuesday, something went up. Yeah. Wednesday went up a bit more. Yeah. Thursday, it went up again.
And that's
Friday,
the narrative and context
exactly.
So vital. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's quite difficult sometimes to do that.
I think, so Shiller talks about bubbles. There's obviously, you know, we maybe can come to the part that media is playing right now, and there's been meme stocks and, you know, social media, which is a whole other side of things. But the railway mania in the 1840s, which is one of these sort of less talked about manias. And basically, you know, railway boom in Britain was taking place, and everyone was investing in railway companies. Mm-hmm. And it all went, you know, belly up, tits up, or something like that. Now, there's been a lot of research done around whether or not the media played a part because, you know, newspapers, it was at the same time that newspapers were really sort of starting to boom as well. I've got some research which, you know, they're talking about how there were several newspapers dedicated to commenting on the railway industry. The railway press arose largely to meet the information needs of the popular investor. These periodicals carried share price tables, editorial commentary, railway stocks, letters from readers, company financial reports, AGMs, etc., etc. And they had these, you know, advertisements for buying stocks on that took up the bulk of the papers. That's part of why people talk about, you know, the sort of the role of the media is anchored in, well, as we said before, tulips and newspapers in Holland, and then, you know, you get this extensive press coverage of financial markets by British news media. You get this idea that the periodicals have an incentive to hype. And this is where, you know, you say, well, the media is doing its job. The Times, which is a leading daily newspaper at the time, along with The Economist, they were actually accused of causing the collapse because of critical editorials where they criticised the mania. So there's a lot going on there about some periodicals are hyping stuff, others are criticising and cautioning. And I guess that's the nature of...
It's the nature of the beast and the nature of different media. You know, in a diverse media landscape, there's nothing wrong with, you know, Railways R Us Chronicle coming along to serve people that are invested in railways and to tell them, you've made a good decision, you're in an exciting space.
Yeah.
Because they can make money off that, and that's a perfectly good business in a free market. Do they have a responsibility to put the red flags up? Depends how the editor feels about their role. Are they just a part of a thriving ecosystem? Yeah. We see this today in things like crypto. You know, there is a lot of cryptocurrency journalism about, and about half of it is journalism.
Right.
Looks at two sides of a story. It might have a slight spin on it one way or the other, positive, negative, but it takes a more objective step back view. And then there are a number of publications which are hyping up the future of finance. And is that journalism? Is that information? There's a line that I think is a little blurrier now than it ever has been. Or maybe I'm wrong, as you look back on there and you've got that. The line there is still blurry.
It's always been there. I mean, some of the commentary from the Times is well worth a read. I won't go into it now, but you talk about crypto. It's interesting, and we started the podcast on that clip from just 20 years ago, and that feels like an alien planet to today's world, where social media drives everything. Crypto is this brand new asset class that swept people up in it. And I think in the notes that you sent me beforehand, they talk about the role of PRs in the financial news media at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, taking a step back, the change in the way people consume information from a newspaper to digital has been, I think, one of the most distinct social changes of the past two centuries, maybe, in terms of an absolute revolution in who has access to information, who is the gatekeeper of information, who's checking that information, who's policing that information, and of course how that information is shared. And I won't go down the fake news and disinformation route, because we could be talking for hours, but by removing that sort of stamp of approval of a newspaper, of we try to do this properly, we without try to be objective without fear or favour, it does complicate matters, and it makes it more difficult for us to cut through. And you look at, you know, a really good example of the way the power dynamics have shifted, and I'm talking myself out of a job here, is, you know, the GameStop saga.
Yeah.
Every newspaper from here to LA was saying, this is weird.
Yeah.
This looks a bit spooky.
Yeah.
What's going on here? And that only served to enthuse those people on Robinhood or whatever who felt like they were sticking one in the eye to the financial establishment, because they felt like the media was part of the establishment. And I think there's no real way of working out what that looks like in 5 to 10 years' time, because we don't know what the technology is going to look like. We don't know what deep fakes are going to look like. You know,
AI providing instant analysis of very long huge submissions to the regulators that normally take journalists maybe a few hours to go through.
SEC filings are not fun to go through. And if AI can do that in a couple of minutes, then of course people are going to go to AI, because like we said earlier, you want to be ahead of the game. The question, of course, is what happens if the AI is wrong?
Yes, and so you'll always need the human.
You will, but by that point, it might be too late, you know, who knows?
But there'll still be a call for good headlines, good stories.
There will, I think. And,
you know,
I think it's also important that you know, in terms of just speaking about CityM and the headlines and why we try and make the paper fun. Mm-hmm. It's our fundamental belief that people that work in finance in the city are doing something that matters. You know, you might be a reinsurance broker and you might occasionally on a Tuesday night think, I'm not sure I really changed the world today. But something you did will have saved somebody £5 on their car insurance. And that matters. It's not just moving money around. You know, if you're a fund manager, you're helping secure a pension for two women in Burnley, whatever it might be.
Sure.
And we want, and I think it's on the duty of financial media to sometimes remind people that this isn't just about money moving around. It is about fun. It is a worthwhile thing to do. And there's a real community of people here who I think deserve to be served and celebrated. And maybe financial journalism, if it shifts, I'm not talking about competition, of course, if it shifts too much into sort of hectoring and everything's bad, then I wonder what, on the one hand, it's a very American way of doing journalism, just the facts, but I don't know that it necessarily is going to be able to survive in a world of instant gratification.
I'm sure it will. I have a hopeful viewpoint, because I think if you look, the point of the, I think we've sort of touched on a bit here, is just the commonality of bubbles and newspapers being sort of talked about in the 1600s in Holland and, you know, 1700s in England, and again and again and again. And so we're discussing the same things that we've always discussed, which is, you know, and the 1840s in Britain with the railways, you know, this idea that there's the media behind it, and the media maybe being behind it, but maybe just reflecting, holding up a mirror to what's happening already.
Yeah, and of course the thing, as we said, you reflect, and the more you reflect, the more that becomes reality. And that's where there is some real strength to the argument about media shaping narrative. And I can confirm, though, you can't create it out of nothing. It's got to come from somewhere.
As Schiller, our friend Robert Schiller, says, you can't have a bubble with word of mouth. So you need a little bit more than
that. You need it on a front page. And the words you choose matter. You know, you look at things like, especially as retail investors get more engaged, which is, you know, I think definitely a good thing. But of course, you know, if everybody starts talking about AI, if that's the phrasing you use, then you pile into AI stocks now. Look at NVIDIA. We could call that a chip-making tech stock, right? Mm-hmm. The word AI could potentially have never appeared. It was just emerging technology for which it made, you know, the plumbing, the chips. Do retail investors go to town on NVIDIA in the way that they have over the past year? It's an open question. I don't know. So I think there's some fun stuff to play with around the language that people use and the narrative. But fundamentally, I'm like you, an optimist. More information for people is a better thing to make their own informed decisions.
Absolutely. Great. Thank you, Andy, very much. That's been really fun. It makes me want to dive into the best manias, you know, tulip bubbles and Mississippi schemes. And I did have a look at my Charles Mackay last night, but I realised I've only got the small edition with the three, and there's a lot more.
Well, maybe
it's a bit nutty, but it's fun.
Maybe that should be CityM's first book project.
Yeah, the best manias of all time, or best or worst. Anyway, thank you, Andy. Thanks for
pleasure.
Your time. Thank you for listening to Overleveraged, and do listen, subscribe, follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Remember, all opinions, news, research, analysis, prices, or other information is provided as general market commentary, not as investment advice, and all potential results discussed are not guaranteed to be achieved. The information may have been derived from publicly available sources, company reports, personal research, or surveys. Past performance is not indicative of future performance. Trading carries risk of capital loss, and the service is available to professional clients only.